Greetings, I'm your host, Patrick Brown, and you're listening to Crown and Crozier. With the start of a new legislative session in Canada's Parliament, and against the backdrop of numerous economic and social crises, there's a lot of chatter about the need for decision makers to, quote-unquote, meet the moment. In this episode, we examine the broad canvas of challenges facing the Great White North, whether the conservative movement in Canada is well-equipped to tackle them, and the need for a renewed discovery and embrace of the transcendent, immutable truths and traditions which serve as the foundation of the country's political and social architecture. Our guest is Stockwell Day, one of the leading emeritus statesmen of Canadian conservatism. From 1986 to 2000, he served as a member of the Alberta legislature and minister of numerous portfolios in the provincial cabinet. From 2000 to 2001, he was leader of the Canadian Alliance and Her Majesty's official opposition in the House of Commons. Following the merger of Canada's two major conservative parties in 2003, he remained as a member of parliament and held multiple cabinet portfolios during the government of former Prime Minister Stephen Harper. Day's long tenure in politics came to a close in 2011 when he declined to run in that year's federal election. Since then, he served on numerous boards and in fellowship positions and has run his own strategic consulting firm, Stockwell Day Connects. We're grateful for you joining us and hope you enjoy this installment of the podcast on church, state, and faithful citizenship.
There are two swords. And the question is, which sword is superior, the spiritual sword or the temporal sword?
And without God, democracy will not and cannot long endure.
I die His Majesty's good servant, but God's first.
Stockwell Day, welcome to Crown and Crozier. It's great to have you.
Great to be with you, Patrick.
I'd like to start with a reference to remarks that the Prime Minister of Canada recently made to his caucus at the start of the new parliamentary session for 2023. He talked a lot about the need for meeting the moment, with the moment being high cost of living, average Canadian struggling with affordability, you name it, all the different economic and social challenges we're facing at this moment. So I thought I'd riff on that a little bit and ask you, what's your thoughts on the state of the current conservative movement in Canada? And is that movement ready to, quote unquote, meet the moment?
Is the movement ready? There is a substantial base of what I would call small C conservative thinking people across the country, obviously large enough that, you know, we come close to winning elections, and we did with Stephen Harper, won the popular vote recently against Justin Trudeau. So that group is there and is present and can win. And if you believe recent polls, it's, you know, tracking above the Liberals. What happens at election time and run up to an election, the basic Liberal approach, as firmly committed to by Justin Trudeau, is that you can quite literally buy the election. And I'm not saying that as under the table bribes or anything like that. You just quite openly increase the amount of promises of things you're going to pay for people. And as generally as people become disenchanted with politics in general, then in both sides, but I'll say on the conservative side, people get a little frustrated. And then if you tell them, you know what, we're just going to take care of all your daycare costs. And people know that in the long run, these kind of gigantic fiscal promises are the ruination of an economy and of a country. But people just get fed up and they get frustrated and they say, you know what, I don't care. I'm going to vote Liberal because they're going to take care of all my daycare. Or they're going to take care, thanks to Jagmeet Singh, they're going to take care of all my dental costs. So that's the state of affairs. There's the broad breadth of people who identify as conservatives, but increasingly just getting frustrated and getting bought out by Liberal promises.
When you hear the Prime Minister and others talk about meeting the moment, in terms of their description or their diagnosis of the moment, do you think there's anything there? Are they accurate in terms of the major economic and social challenges facing the country? Or do you think they're just kind of at the surface and you know, what's actually at the root and the depths of all this? What's your take on the current moment?
Well, the roots and the depths are a firm commitment, and it's largely buttressed by most of what people get at university, certainly in high schools, related to economic issues. And that is what we know or would identify as a Keynesian type approach, which is basically that you can borrow your way out of anything. And then when the economy, if it starts to level out a bit, you spend radically. That ratchets up over time the amount of money that is actually owing by a government to the place where you start to lose credibility in fiscal platforms around the world. And so we saw that happen. The last finance minister who identified this was Paul Martin, and way back in 1993, 94. And at that time, and media, broadly speaking, media doesn't like to talk about this, but the World Bank actually said to Canada, your financial credibility is on the line. Your costs of borrowing are going to keep going up. You are teetering on becoming a bad credit country. And that was so shocking. It finally, you know, was so shocking. Paul Martin understood that. He convinced Chrétien something had to be done. And you saw then in the last 60 years, as much as I like to talk about things we did in Alberta financially, he was really the last finance minister who really radically took on the false thinking of Keynesian economics, and you recall, really cut government spending and government services and turned the thing around. Jim Flaherty and Joe Oliver definitely took a conservative bead on things. And under Stephen Harper, we saw the budgets being balanced again. But it was really, you know, Paul Martin really headed that off. And if you don't do that, you as a government wind up creating the problem. And then you don't want to admit there's a problem. So you just blithely keep heading down an economic road to disaster. And just as John Keynes was famously asked by a student in one of his lectures, when you keep doing this borrow, spend cycle, in the long run, doesn't it all collapse, the whole economic system? And many of your listeners will know John Keynes responded by saying, well, in the long run, we'll all be dead. Now, that was it. That was the summation of his decades of economic study. And prompted by an honest question from an honestly searching student. But you know what? Yes, in the long run, we'll all be dead, but my kids won't be, and my grandkids won't be, and they will continue to be living under a diminished standard of living because of this foolish approach to spend and borrow.
May I ask then, when you cast your glance forward, what's it going to take and how much more needs to erode before the proverbial collar of the finance minister is shaken and the prime minister and the people in charge, the collar is shaken? And I mean, is it going to take the World Bank or another organization to read the Riot Act of Canada before we straighten the ship, or what's required in that regard?
Well, that's a great question, Patrick, because something else has been eroding over time. And I'm just going to say last 60 years. And that is, as this is largely speaking now, so let's say Canadian, North American, or Western thinking, will include European on this, as many of the things that used to sort of be pillars of economic strength are ceased to be seen as attractive by an increasing number of the population, especially, you know, pick a number, 18 to say 45 year olds, for instance, having a family which requires purchasing a house. It requires having a job that allows you to make those payments. It requires having a pretty versatile free market economy to allow people to truly get ahead. So the drive for that among large numbers of the population, now increasing large number, is subsiding. And, you know, I got a lot of grandkids and we've got kids and they've got friends. So I do. They are a constant, the friends that hang out with friends of these ages are a constant focus group for me. I go to the gym with my grandkids. We go to games. We hang out on holidays. So I look I listen anecdotally to what they're saying, and then I compare it to some of the pretty deep-seated studies that are going on the same way, and I find the comparisons the same. I'm not saying my grandkids think like this, but here's the thing. there is this moving away from some of the things that used to be key drivers upon us as a population that would almost guarantee that your economy would stay relatively strong. If you're buying a house, you want to make sure you've got a job. You don't like the government cranking up rates. Governments that increase go wild on the regulatory side and drive up costs. All of these things the population increasingly pushes back against. But what's really, I think one of the things that really was exposed during the COVID time is the willingness of a large swath of the population to say, you know what, government, I'll tell you what, if you make sure there's a roof over my head and I'm warm in the winter, especially from Canada, I'm going to be able to get some decent, you know, albeit organic food. And as long as I can have that internet, as long as I can have my device, I'm good. Now, people think I exaggerate. Some people think I exaggerate when I say that that's an increasingly prevailing mood. But I think Klaus Schwab, for all of his honesty, and he is an honest person as well as being a, you know, a voracious globalist, he did say, you will own nothing, you will rent, and you will be happy. People take that as a threat. That was a very clear prediction because he sees, because of how governments are desperately seeking to get reelected in every sphere in the Western Hemisphere, and they will say and do anything to get that vote. So that's why I'm somewhat pessimistic. I used to be able to say, you know what, people are going to wake up and people are going to get tired of this. But increasingly, we have a large part of the population, and again, somewhat exposed by what was going on in COVID. They're happy to stay home, happy to work from home, in fact, increasingly militantly demanding to do so, and just not pursuing the things that a generation, let's say my generation, pursued. I could not wait at the time, to get my driver's license, for instance. These might be little points of light in terms of a broader picture, but I've talked to kids and people in this age group, you know, coming up to 16, 17, increasingly, not the same desire to get a driver's license, to own a car for some of the reasons they've been told. If they drive a car, they're part of the destroying of the planet. Certainly not to have a home, certainly not to pursue a family. So that driving, significant driving edge of the population, that's being eroded alongside of the economy that is promising to keep those people happy.
The subset of the population that you just described, I mean, it seems like there's this growing dependence on government support and the comfort that only government can provide. And underlying that dependence is a sense of trust. I think some of us would describe that as a misplaced sense of trust, but there's trust underlying that dependence. And then on the flip side, there's a large subset of the population whose trust in government and whose trust in public institutions is significantly eroding. And to your earlier point around COVID having exacerbated this, here we are on what seems to be the other side of the pandemic. And you look around, and in terms of defining the moment that the prime minister is referring to, there are many voices who say, well, let's look at what's defining the moment. 24-hour wait times in hospitals, maybe that's generous. Some hospital wait times longer than 24 hours. Inability for governments to do basic services like providing a passport in a timely manner. Inability for the next generation or members of the current generation to afford a house. Inflation, rising interest rates. Here in Canada, we have what seems to be across the country, a larger appetite on the part of individual provinces for sovereignty and to do their own thing, to have more autonomy in the way they do their business because there is such a lack of distrust. Do you think it's an acceptable proposition that this fault line between dependence that's undergirded by trust and an eroding or perhaps an already evaporated sense of trust being major drivers and definers of this current moment?
Yeah, you've hit on a couple of key points there, for sure. Trusting the government, but trusting the government to what? People more and more could care less about the individuals in government and the things that seem to, you know, motivate individual politicians or leaders. The trust factor now is more and more, and I'm not saying in a noble sense of trust, but there's this sense that the money that it will take to keep me fairly comfortable, not rich, this is what most people, I don't care about being rich, but fairly comfortable, there's this false sense of trust that that money actually is never going to run out. That who's ever in government is, you know, going to fork over what's required to keep me warm, as I said, to keep me fairly well fed, and to keep my internet on. And basically, I'm good with that. Then if you throw in the fact that you promise to take care of the environment and the world isn't going to come to an end in the year 2030 at midnight, 12:30 in Newfoundland, then you promise that, you've got my vote. That's increasingly, so that's where the trust is going. There's a false sense of security that the money will all be there. And then when you have a media that largely is lulled into that also because of what they've been taught, you know, broadly speaking, at universities, and now because they too, this is the irony, Patrick, as you know, as you know, a guy and as an organization trying to make it in the world of media, and I'm guessing your coffers are not overflowing with government funds like many networks are. And so you've got a media that also, they're saying, look, as long as the government takes care of us as journalists, we'll not be too tough on the government in this regard. So they won't report, for instance, with the ongoing state of Venezuela, why so many countries in South America are suffering, why people by the millions, and it's heartbreaking to see, are willing to swim across the river into the United States, do whatever they can to escape that. We have a complete lack of, first of all, I used to think it was intellectual honesty, a lack of intellectual honesty. Now it's just intellectual impairment. I really believe most in mainstream media are just not allowing themselves to believe this moment. The defining moment is one of just keep me comfortable, you got my vote. What they don't realize is even those comforts, which will become lessened in the years ahead if we don't pull out of this, even those comforts are going to become less, and we will be we will be like Venezuela, one of the wealthiest, one of the highest standards of living, one of the lowest percentage of poor in their population some decades ago. And as they track onto this irresponsible approach to a government that basically unwittingly lies to people to say we can take care of the rest of your life, you do wind up in starvation. You do wind up in social chaos. And people would say that can never happen in Canada. Well, then you have never read a decent history book in your life if you're saying that. Because we are on, as some call it, the road to serfdom, as some would say, road to financial perdition. We are on a road to rapidly decreasing standard of living, and that will affect our health care, that will affect everything we do, and we will be. We absolutely will be like Venezuela, and the people who come here from Venezuela shake their heads, and they say to me and they say to others, do Canadians not realize where this is headed? Do Canadians not realize these were the same promises we were given in Venezuela and Argentina, if you keep going back, in different countries by politicians desperate to get reelected? Canadians don't realize where we're headed. We're headed to Venezuela.
A lot of what we've spoken about so far involves, to be sure, material matters. And I want to talk about how this particular moment, one of its defining features could very well be as well a diminishing sense of the transcendent, of eternal principles and tenets that have underpinned our society for so long and which are now being eroded, dismantled, assaulted, choose whichever verb you like. Is it a coincidence at all in your mind? It's a bit of a rhetorical question, but is there any coincidence, or is it ironic that a lot of what we're talking about in terms of the challenges of the moment is also taking place against a backdrop of a decline in religious affiliation on the part of much of the population, and also limitations and restrictions on freedom of expression that are being imposed, which often involve a limitation on the part of believers to share their faith or to share their understanding of morality in the public square.
Sure, you could do a documentary series just on the key points you've touched on there, Patrick. There is a complete, first of all, an unwillingness, increasingly, let's say spiritually or metaphysically, there's an unwillingness to want to deal with the question of, are there in existence time-tested principles which, if followed, yield to an increase, let's say, in social well-being, and where, if not followed, will lead to a decrease in social well-being and standard of living? Are there certain time-tested principles that we can look at that would reflect that proposition? And, you know, you can look to go to any of the great faiths and find some pretty resounding answers to that. But I was just meeting with a number of people of the Jewish faith, and we were talking about, there's a chapter in the book of Deuteronomy, it's the 28th chapter, and it was proposed that you could use that, Deuteronomy 28, as a measure, as a barometer of almost every country or every civilization that has existed, because it starts out with this premise in the first, I don't know, 10, 15 verses. It says, if you do these things, and it lists a bunch of stuff, you will have, and then it talks about, you will have financial stability. You will have familial stability. You'll have social stability. You'll have strong agriculture. It's quite an amazing proposition that's being put out there. If you follow these certain principles, time-tested principles, which, you know, we might call it the Judeo-Christian faith, other religions would point to similar things. And then the rest of this chapter, which goes on for many, many verses, it says, however, so I call this the grand choice. It's the grand cosmic choice. However, if you don't want to follow these things, then here's what will happen. And it talks about your finances. And this applies to a country, to a state, to a province, to a city. It could apply to a family. What will start to happen? Well, your finances are going to start to fall apart. You're going to have trouble with agriculture. It's interesting. It keeps pointing to that. You're going to have trouble in the cities. You're going to have trouble in the country. You're going to eventually be seen as an easy target for bellicose nations around you that will invade, want to take over. And so they were saying, you know, consider that, consider Deuteronomy 28. So if we use that as a paradigm of source of sorts, I think if people can detach themselves emotionally from the argument, which I find most can't, you will see a reflection of what you just said, that there are a number of people, I'm one of those, that I do believe there are some time-tested eternal principles that, if followed, will yield to a better standard of living than if not followed. So that's the broad premise. If you want to drill down to that further, we can do it. But that's the broad premise. So I'm saying, yes, I agree. And more people are departing from that. One of the big reasons they're departing from that is it's not being taught. It's not being passed on. And when you talk about religious affiliation, when we hear the polling done about, you know, it's generally the old line denominational population that is being looked at. What's happened, certainly in North America, and I think we can say this globally in the Western world, there's been a move away from denominational affiliation, but there's been quite a robust growth of the smaller sort of independent church movement. You can argue whether that's good or bad, but overall, there's still a decline, but it's not quite as precipitous as some are saying if they only look at what's happening in the mainline denominational church. So whether the continuance of these truths are going to be carried by less by denominational affiliation and more by independent religious affiliation, that's going to remain to be seen.
What comes to mind in this conversation, I think of Russell Kirk, the author of the conservative mind, and in that book he lays out certain core principles which are unique and which are shared amongst conservative movements in different countries and in different times in history. And in Russell Kirk's mind, he sees conservatives as natural custodians of the argument and the practice that there are eternal truths which animate the human experience individually and collectively, and that conservatives are inherently less inclined to mess with those, to muddle with those, or to go searching for alternative philosophies and ideologies to to undermine or substitute tried, tested, and true principles and tenets. What's your sense of the current conservative movement in Canada and its relative success to continue serving as a custodian for that concept?
I think it was Russell Kirk who famously said, you can't improve a society by lighting it on fire.
Mm.
And that's largely, you know, we see that in a very literal sense in the streets of, well, Canada to a degree, much more in the United States. So yes, the small C conservative movement would tend to be the repository of these kind of commitments to what they believe in electorally are time-tested principles. But those are being eroded, I'd say more than people individually, and then as groups who would call themselves conservatives, are being browbeaten and threatened and frankly canceled more and more because the basic shift, the center of gravity in society general is much more to a liberal mode where every individual is king or queen, or a combination depending on the preferred pronoun of the day. And there's a real move to shut you up individually or corporately the more you dare to articulate these values and so on. I mean, nobody questions that. The mood of cancellation is rampant. It's frightening to people. You have entire companies, businesses. You have the church community, which is sadly quiet. I spoke to because of the fear of cancellation, the repercussions of speaking up. And this is never new in history. When a society moves to a certain place where the critical mass become convinced the best thing you can do is shut down the voice from the outside and punish or launch an inquisition, when you have that fear factor built in, you have a real diminishing of the potential that these principles are going to be articulated or expressed. And so 2 years ago, I spoke to a World Congress, a certain denomination, it doesn't matter which one, but they meet every 2 years, and they asked me to speak. And I said, let's just use one area. I said, never in human history have we seen a move as radical as we have to this concept that it's not just acceptable, but it should be pursued to alter the gender of children. I'm leaving adults. Adults have the right to. You can identify any way you want, and you have the right to, you know, pursue whether it's surgical methods or pharmaceutical methods. That's your right as a human being, and I actually support that right. I might not agree with it, but never before have we seen the rush to see children altered. And here's the thing on top of this, and it's always happened. You've always had different forms of this, you know, in different societies, but we've never seen where parents have not been allowed to counsel their children lovingly and respectively, or where clinicians have not been allowed to counsel their clients to at least say, let's consider all the evidence. So I'm just using that as an example of how far down the road we move. You say about conservative expressing these things, you are literally canceled. You will be removed from the public sphere. This is a bludgeoned, blunt instrument that's being used with such force today that, as I said to this congregational group 2 years ago from around the world, you're silent on this issue. And can you tell me why? And they said, largely, we're afraid of losing our tax status, and we're afraid of being labeled as unkind or mean, even if, you know, their expression on this particular subject was loving and respectful. So that has really ramped up that fear. I'm just using that as one example. I'm using that particular topic. I don't have a particular agenda on it. Speaking up, or if you want to present, as many scientists are trying to do, some reasoned approaches to some of the downsides of methods being taken to deal with climate issues. If you want to raise a concern, if you want to talk about the fact, for instance, as I did in a grocery store yesterday, that the use of paper bags is every bit, has consequences as far-reaching or more as the use of plastic bags, nobody wants that conversation. If you try to raise that conversation, you face anger, you face cancellation to agree. the whole issue related to our health and related to how governments have responded to COVID. Of course, people should have the choice and should be allowed to pursue informed health decisions. But that's another entire area. If you have or had a differing view, even if it was massively supported by Nobel science doctors, it doesn't matter. You will be canceled. You will lose your license. So this is this blunt instrument of cancellation is very effectively being used to literally pound in a submission those that you're referring to in this great repository of conservative thought who would dare to speak up.
You mentioned Deuteronomy in one of your past remarks. I want to put forward a companion to that, the Book of Exodus. I think there are some members of the conservative movement and the Conservative Party in Canada right now, particularly religious-minded members of the party and of the movement, who feel a little lost in the desert. They feel a little lost in the wilderness. And a recent phenomenon that's emerged in past years, particularly at the provincial level, but also at the federal, is alternative conservative parties coming to the fore, many of them a little more populist in their posture or their rhetoric, arguably. But they're attracting a lot of religiously minded citizens and religiously minded conservatives who have historically been active or engaged or given their allegiance and support to the established conservative party. I mean, there's many examples in this regard, perhaps the most prominent being the Wild Rose Party in Alberta. But even in the most recent provincial election here in the province of Ontario, there was no less than two alternative conservative parties who were contesting the election and drawing some of the traditional conservatives from the establishment fold into their camps. What do you make of this, and where do you see this phenomenon headed? And I think it's important to remind our listeners that, I mean, you've lived through some of this before. You were part of a merger of conservative parties. You've spoken with, you've engaged for decades with different members of the conservative fold of different mindsets, including the religiously informed and the religiously animated ones. So where do you see this recent phenomenon ongoing, and what are your general thoughts on?
Well, sure. That's a great predictive observation you've made. And people do say, why does it seem that small C conservatives are the ones who split and hive off into different groups? Well, by very definition, we tend to put a lot of emphasis, rightly so, on the rights and the focus on the individual, on personal rights, on human rights, which tend to get pretty personal. And so we think more individualistically. We don't think collectively like liberals do, like the socialists do. And more and more liberals are just socialists. They say, what's the expression? Socialists are just liberals in a hurry. liberals and socialists, the NDP, and largely now the Democrat Party in the U.S., they just tend to think more collectively. And so conservatives, we get fiercely individualistic, and so we atomize into these different parties. And you're right, in 2000, we were well on the way to, it was largely successful, the move to, because here we had the Conservative Party federally, and you had the Reform Party federally, and that guaranteed one thing, the Liberals would form governments forever. And in the Reform Party, Preston Manning, to his credit, and others said, you know what, I think we've got to stop this. We've got to try and pull together into a larger group. Can we pull conservatives together, progressive conservatives, whatever that juxtaposition of words means, along with, let's say, reformers? Can we pull those two together? And so the experiment launched, and it was the Canadian Alliance. It was it was becoming successful. The election in 2000 almost knocked the progressive conservatives. The stubbornness of Joe Clark kept it from happening, but almost knocked them down, almost took away their status in Parliament. But no sooner had that got on the road than what happened? Starts fragmenting again, because people are so fiercely individualistic, they forget the larger collective, and as true conservatives wind up shooting each other out of the saddle. Thankfully, at the same time, the liberals, thinking that this would last forever, these conservatives continuing to splinter and shoot their own, they started their own fight with Paul Martin and with Jean Chrétien. Jean Chrétien, I remember, I actually got along with him fairly well, even though we disagreed a lot on stuff. He told me very clearly, if Paul Martin comes at me, he's going to be very sorry. And it was that split that allowed, with Stephen Harper as then leader, first of the Canadian Alliance, and then masterfully pulling together the stubborn progressive conservatives back into one party, were able to capitalize on what? On the Liberals in one of their rare splits. And then, you know, the conservatives under Stephen Harper were able to demonstrate to Canadians, hey, you can have a pretty stable government here. You can have a balanced budget and you can still enjoy the good things in life. But it's this tendency to continue to split. So your question is right. These parties are going to continue to split, I fear. And that will continue to give the left-leaning parties who, even though they don't particularly like each other, they've learned you just swallow those differences. You stick together as a collective group and you can overwhelm the single-minded conservatives in an electoral race. So, you know, if I'm sounding pessimistic in all this, you know, they say the difference between an optimist and a pessimist is the pessimist usually has more information. So, you know, that's kind of what I'm dealing with. Do I believe it can turn around? Yes, I do. Some things pretty substantially are going to have to happen. How likely, if I had to bet just coldly, analytically, that it's going to turn around? Well, there's some recent polling that federal conservatives are, you know, maybe the ideas are catching on. They're pulling ahead a bit. And I'll be working hard for small C conservatives to get it done. But if I had to bet, I would think that we will see Liberal policies, unfortunately, continue to prevail. Even some of those policies being adopted into the federal party, as strong a leader as we have now with Pierre Poilievre, and I just super individual, super smart person. But here's what you constantly hear, Patrick, in the caucus meetings. It is, no, you can't raise that subject. No, the media is going to kill us on this subject. Mm. And here's the phrase, is this the hill to die on? Right. Well, you know, we're running out of hills to die on as conservatives. And it's time conservatives started to be willing to stand on some of these hills, which have been pillars of our own belief system. And yeah, be willing to die politically and take that chance. Because if we don't articulate these things, they will be lost completely to the other generation. And we'll continue to lose our standard of living. And we continue to see a loss in our ability to pursue our dreams the way we want to.
Stockwell, I think that's a great place to leave off our conversation. A call, a summons to sacrifice, to remember that there are some things worth contesting and perhaps providing the ultimate contest in the sacrifice of our lives and our livelihoods. Thanks so much for joining us today. We really appreciate your time.
I enjoyed it very much. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in. If you like what you heard, don't forget to subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcasts. And help us to reach more listeners by leaving us a rating or referring us to a friend. If you'd like to partner with us in the delivery of this podcast, head on over to our website at crownandcrozier.com and click the heart button in the top right-hand corner to learn more about making a one-time or monthly donation. We're sincerely grateful for you listening in, and we look forward to providing you with future episodes on church, state, and faithful citizenship. Until then, God bless.